Week we're going to talk about the forces of the devotional life, and it'll become clear what that means. We're doing a series on deepening the experience of centering prayer, the practice of centering prayer, but really this is deepening the entire devotional life. What is the devotional life? It's the connection that we have with God. It's our experience of God's presence. It's our knowledge of God beyond what's just in our heads, but that is in our hearts that we live by. It's our fellowship with God. It's our union with Him. That's the devotional life. And when we talk about the forces of the devotional life, really we're talking about what is the way that the devotional life grows more deep, that our relationship with God becomes more deep. So most of this group began centering prayer, I think, pretty much at the beginning of this year. Don and I, maybe 2 years now, Bob about 18 months. And so you might say, well, I'm a beginner. Why am I doing a series now on deepening the experience? I think it's very valuable and important because we're looking at different layers of truth that Christianity puts out there that describe the devotional life. And these layers anchor you, help to anchor you in what you're doing. They help you to expand your expectation of what God's going to do. And it helps you to understand what you're doing towards God. And a way of thinking about this is practically in centering prayer, there are two things happening. You reaching out to God with your sacred word, which is a prayer that's coming from your heart, and God is doing stuff in you. And those are, I just want to use the word forces. Those are, in a sense, that one, you reaching out is one of the forces. And then everything God does in you is another one of the forces. So let's dive into it. James 4 verse 8 says something quite interesting. And James is a pretty heavy book. Martin Luther actually questioned whether the book of James should be in the Bible. But anyway, James is in the Bible. And James says, 4 verse 8 says, draw near to God and He will draw near to you. But at first glance, that appears almost equal forces. It appears that what you need to do to access God is as much effort as what He will then do towards you. But we know that that's absolutely not correct. We know that it's not for every step we take, God takes a step. It's we do just a very small thing, and then God takes an infinite distance towards us and does everything. Because Christ has already crossed the infinite divide, God already came and has already accessed everything that needs to be accessed. So they're not equal forces. And bear with me as I deal with this concept of forces, because it's quite an important concept. So James says, draw near to God and He will draw near to you. But the book of Hebrews uses the concept of draw near most often and helps to explain what it really looks like. So Hebrews 4 verse 16, for example, says, draw near to the throne of grace. There's this massive amount of grace available from God to us. We just need to come and get it. And then Hebrews 7, 25, he says, He is able to save forever those who draw near. So again, just a little step from us, just a little bit of openness, and boom, there's this huge response. And I guess this comes down to the nub of what I want to share with us today. And that is the distinction between karma, and grace. The distinction between karma and grace. And one of our modern day prophets says this very well, and that's Bono from the music band U2. So bear with me as I read you what Bono says about karma versus grace. And also, Baron, I'm just going to use his exact language, so excuse the one profanity that's going to come out, but it's very powerful. Bono says, "It's a mind-blowing concept that the God who created the universe might be looking for company, a real relationship with people. But the thing that keeps me on my knees is the difference between grace and karma. You see, at the center of all religions is the idea of karma. You know, what you put out comes back to you. An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. Or in physics, in physical laws, every action is met by an equal and opposite one. It's clear to me that karma is at the very heart of the universe. I'm absolutely sure of it. But now listen to what he says. And yet, along comes this idea called grace to upend all of that. As you reap, you will sow stuff. Grace defies logic and reason. Love interrupts, if you like, the consequences of your actions, which in my case is very good news indeed, because I've done a lot of stupid stuff. That's between me and God. I'd be in big trouble if karma was going to finally be my judge. I'd be in deep shit. It doesn't excuse my mistakes, but I'm holding out for grace. I'm holding out that Jesus took my sins onto the cross because I know who I am, and I hope I don't have to depend on my own religiosity. The point of the death of Christ is that Christ took on the sins of the world so that what we put out did not come back to us, and that our sinful nature does not reap the obvious death. That's the point. It should keep us humbled. It's not our own good works that get us through the gate of heaven." I hope you like that, but the point is that centering prayer and the devotional life are not about you making a ton of effort to try and earn a response from God. It's about relying on grace, consenting to grace, accepting everything that God's already done. I mean, Newton's third law, which Bono kind of touches on, says for every action there's an equal and opposite reaction. And it seems to be how the world works. In fact, early religions had that. The Old Testament, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. What you sow, you will reap. But then came along Christ. And God said, you know what, you guys aren't... just doesn't seem to be working for you. And he came and he gave himself fully and completely to us. He gave himself in love, and that's grace. So the forces of attraction aren't equal in the devotional life. We just have to do something very simple, and that's consent. And when we consent and open up our hearts, which is basically saying yes, then God blows like the wind. And so that's the key to centering prayer. And in this series, we're examining some of the forces that we are meant to exert towards God, and then understanding what are the forces that he exerts back towards us. I want to throw in here, and maybe the ladies amongst us have an easier time with this, but one of the problems of being a male is the ego. I suspect, my wife tells me it may also exist in women, I don't know. But the thing about the ego is the ego likes to control things and earn things. And so karma is actually a more natural outflowing of the ego. It's like, I want to feel like I made this happen because I'm controlling it. So the thing that grace dismantles, it is the ego, because God comes to you despite any of your efforts, despite any of your goodness or supposed goodness. Centering prayer and the whole devotional life a gentle action of consent, surrender, waiting, release, and dying to our ego's need to control things. In fact, sometimes it's almost like if we try to exert the wrong force towards God, if we try to earn it, He steps back to a degree and allows us to build up a frustration to see that that's not working. It's quite a biblical idea. I love 1 Peter where it says, God gives grace to the humble. And if you humble yourself, you'll be exalted. But if you exalt yourself, you'll be humbled. So our job is to humble ourselves. God's job is to exalt us. And then I love this, that if you try to do God's job, He does your job. So if you try to exalt yourself, then He humbles you. But another example of this is Isaiah 64, where verse 4, where it says, He's a God who works for those who wait on Him. So when you wait, God begins to work for you. But when you start working, God kind of waits for you to just exhaust your ego. And then when you find that quiet place again, that place of trusting and depending on grace, then he does so much. So what are some of these forces, just before we end, by which we draw near, by which we approach God? What are the things we do? What are the spiritual postures that we adopt in centering prayer? Well, consent is the huge one. That's what your sacred word means. Your sacred word's a prayer, and every time you say your sacred word, you're consenting to God's presence and His action in your life. And then what else are you doing? You're waiting. It's humbling to wait. Thomas Keating says the one thing about waiting is it's humbling. You're waiting for the other person to respond. You're resting. You're letting go of things that drive you, and you're saying, I don't want those things. I'm resting. You're surrendering. Don's going to share on surrender. You're receiving. You're receiving grace. And you're glancing with faith. I specifically use the term glancing because sometimes if we say, well, you need to have faith, so many of us think, wow, I don't know how to have faith. That just feels like something for the gifted. I don't know how to do that. But faith is just the glance of the heart at God. You just got to look with your heart. That's faith. So those are the things we do. Those are our spiritual forces. And then what are God's moves? Well, God's move, number one, is to love us. And we only love because He first loved us. God's move is to love us. What does that mean? It means He gives Himself to us. Just like He gave Christ, He gives Himself in an ongoing way. God pours out grace. We approach the throne of grace. He pours out grace to us. He gives us His presence, His Holy Spirit. He transforms our inner world. He does a miracle in our inner world. And He replaces the false self with His nature. You can't do that. You can't psychoanalyze yourself into becoming like Christ. And then He works in our external world. There's no question of that. And there's so many more things that I would call just byproducts. Spiritual healing, divine wisdom, insights. There's no limits to the gifts of the Holy Spirit. But really, they're just byproducts. What we want is Him. So these are the topics we're exploring in these weeks. And And, you know, you don't have to be a master and understand all of these. Really, centering prayer is very simple, just to recap as we go into a time now. You really just have to listen to the first or second part of our introductory series. And that's that you're going to pray a prayer with your sacred word, which says, I consent to your presence and action, but you're making it short. So your sacred word is code for that. And then you're going to wait, and you're going to be in stillness and silence. And then God is going to do many things. But whenever a distracting thought comes, or any thought, you're going to put that aside, even if it's a wonderful thought, and you're going to re-pray the prayer with your sacred word. And that's it. That's centering prayer. And as that happens, God's presence, His love, all of those forces of God flow towards us. So, let's prepare for some centering prayer.